Dr. Peter Cooper to share his testimony, and he's going to mix a little bit with the Word. Many of you know the Coopers. They were here on staff at CBC on faculty for several years and have an amazing story. Both of them have earned doctorates from Gordon-Conwell University, or seminary rather, and that means they've worked a lot, okay? That's what that means. But they are a gift to our movement, and they're in between right now on things, and it's just an honor. And Peter, I want you to come, and I really want you to tell some of your story, if you will, tonight. We love you. So glad. Here at Central, they are part of children's ministry in their years here, and we're going to pray for them at the close of tonight. But would you welcome Dr. Peter to Central tonight?
Well, good evening. And Pastor, thank you very much for this opportunity to be able to share tonight. Central certainly has been our home, both when we were students and while we were teaching over at CBC, and we are so thankful. I could probably list name after name after name after name of individuals in here who poured into our lives, and some of you know some of the difficult points that we even had in our time here as students, and you will never know how important and how valuable your ministry has been to me, to my wife, to my family. Central is our Springfield home and always will be. You have a great heritage here. Men and women of God who have suffered a great deal to answer God's call upon their lives to bring the good news of Jesus Christ, not just to Springfield, not just to the United States, but around the world. I mean, your ministers, your missionaries, you are the people that when we come to Springfield, we look to and say, man, you are amazing. You are amazing for what you have done. And thank you so much for your faithfulness in service to the Lord, to his kingdom, and to the kingdom work. You are an example to us, and we thank you so much for that. It's incredibly important to me on a personal level. I've mixed a little bit of my story in, but I do want to actually spend some time in God's Word tonight because I think that it blends well even with your lives, with my life, with the world in which we live. You see, I was born to a 16-year-old single mother in a small lumber town. Now, if any of you have been from a small town, you know a teenage unwed mother, news is going to get around. And so it didn't go too well. It wasn't looked upon too favorably. My mom was actually the fourth of six kids. And when my grandparents initially found out, they looked at my mom, and this is what my mom had shared with me. She said, look, you need to abort him. This is back in the 70s. My mom said no. So my grandparents said, well, then you need to give him up for adoption. My mom said, no way, not going to do it. Now, some people don't always make the best decisions, and sometimes I've questioned my mom's decision, but I love her dearly. Please don't hear me wrong. But I know the troubles that she then endured afterwards. We see it even in our day where we have teenage pregnancy all over, and we know what the problems that they face and that they endure. And because of that, my mom ended up getting into a lot of trouble. She ran away from home, went down into Oregon, and eventually she found herself with the police due to drugs that were found in that area that she wasn't engaged in, of course. And she found herself in a foster home. And this particular foster home happened to be an elderly pastoral couple. I cannot help but think, in fact, I'm certain of it, that that pastoral couple prayed for my mom and prayed for me. Well, over the next couple years, my mom got into some more trouble and she got pregnant a second time. This time, my grandparents said, look, you're going to marry the guy. And it was the decision that even my grandfather, 14, 15 years later, said, I wish we hadn't have done that. My mom married this man and afterwards found out that he was a self-professed atheist. Well, growing up in this particular home, I ended up with two more sisters and a little brother, and we grew up in a home that was incredibly abusive. I have vivid pictures, vivid memories still of watching this man literally beat my mom with a cast iron skillet. This man was just violent, abusive in every sense of the word. And this was the kind of home that we grew up in. On top of that, he didn't want to work. So we found ourselves living in the projects, low income. I remember standing in the government cheese lines. And by the way, don't knock the government cheese. That makes some of the best grilled cheese sandwiches I have ever had. But if any of you remember, they were those 5-pound blocks in the cardboard boxes. Great cheese. I wish they still had it. I don't know if they do, but who knows. It was good cheese. But I remember having to go to the community center to get hand-me-down clothing because we could not afford it because this man refused to work. He would not take care of his family, but abused them and used them. So growing up in the projects, this is where I was located. And I found that there was this church bus that would come and pick up the kids. And for me, at a young age, it was all about escape. And I would hop on that bus, and I would go to the church. I mean, I can still picture the whole flannel graph lessons sitting on the bleachers. I can picture the common area where they would have us do all the crafts. I have one vivid memory where they had this church fair, and one of the deacons or pastors, I don't even know who he was, but I just remember the fact that his hand was stepped on by a horse that he was trying to shoe as a demonstration. But I remember it. I remember even going underneath the pew and hiding and playing every once in a while, all because I wanted to escape what was going on at home. Got into a lot of trouble, made a lot of bad decisions. About the age of 12, my mom divorced this man. She remarried about a year and a half later, and to tell you the truth, I was angry. I was so furious because I was the oldest. And I remember actually looking at my mom and saying, "Mom, you needed to ask me first. I'm the man of the house." Yeah. Well, if she had asked me first, she already knew what my answer would have been. No way. And my mom married an ex-alcoholic who every once in a while would go out on drinking binges. And those were fun times at home. Well, this man moved us away, and we went to Montana for about 6 months. We lived in a teepee, of all things, during the summer. Wonderful time, a wonderful experience, not something I'd want to do again, but it was a learning experience. But then he moved us back to Washington State, and during this time, we had found out more of what my mom's first husband had done. And I remember the only thing that at that point in time, as a 14-year-old, the only reason I wanted anything to do with this new man that my mom had married was because he was pretty handy with tools. And I was so angry with what this man had done. I would sit and I would talk with my mom's second husband and say, "You know, can we build something together?" Now, I'm 14 years old, and 14-year-olds make a lot of stupid decisions, and we're very ignorant, and we think that we can do things that we can't. And so while we're in Montana, I'm thinking, we're going to make this crossbow, and I'm going to leave my family here, go to Washington, kill this man. I mean, this is really where I was at the age of 14. And I'm going to get back, and nobody will ever know I was missing. There are a lot of disconnects there, if you know what I mean. How am I going to get there? How am I going to get back? And sure, they're not going to miss me at all the next morning. We all have our own stories of suffering. Many of you could probably even talk about and share the points of suffering that you have in your own life. Maybe it was the loss of a loved one. Pastor Mike, even as you were praying about some of those who are dealing with cancer, I know that loss because in the middle of our time here at CBC as students, I lost my mom to cancer. And I remember sitting there, my wife and I talking, and I'm just sitting there. I'm Pentecostal. I believe in divine healing. But God, why will you not heal my mom? And I remember sitting with her overnight when she got her chemo treatment, the one and only treatment that she received. The doctors had given her 6 to 8 months, and she died within 4 weeks. And I remember saying, "God, why?" There is that suffering of those things that happen around us, the loss of our family members. Sometimes it could be decisions that are made by others around us that impact our own lives. Sometimes it's our own decisions that bring about suffering in our lives. And probably every one of us could say, you know, here's the decision I made, and this was the consequence, what I had to endure, what I had to work through. The sad thing is that oftentimes in our suffering, we can do one of two things. Often as believers, we look to the one true hope that we have. We look to Jesus and we're like, I know that God is faithful and I know that he will get me through. It doesn't necessarily do away with that feeling of suffering that we're going through. It's still there, but there is a hope. But probably any one of us could look and say, but you know, I've had Christian friends that have suffered, either through their own actions or through the actions of others. And because of that suffering, there was just something that went on inside of them. They could not look to our one and only hope. They could not look to God, to Jesus, to say, Lord, get me through this. And they're no longer even walking with the Lord anymore. We probably have unsaved friends or family that because of what they've endured, the suffering that has come again either by others' actions or by their own actions, instead of turning to God in hope, in faith, saying, I know you can get me through this. I know that it may not do away with the suffering altogether, but you can get me through this. Instead, they're shaking this angry hand at God and blaming him for it. Sometimes it's just about a perspective of our suffering. How do we understand it? How do we see it? What does God have to say about it? And this takes me to one of my favorite passages, at least over these last few years. It's been a passage that I have wrestled with, and it's a familiar passage. It's that passage that people use the little stuffed animals in the nursery, and they decorate their nursery with the ark and the stuffy, fluffy bears and lions and tigers and everything else. And we paint it in nice blues and yellows and greens, and the nursery just looks absolutely wonderful. And we walk in, we're like, whoa, can't wait for the baby to get here. And yet, this is probably one of the most problematic passages that I've looked at. You see, this passage about Noah and about the whole incident of the flood is one of suffering. I mean, think about what actually ends up happening here. God comes to Noah and says, look, my heart is grieved with the wickedness that I see. In fact, if you have your Bibles, I would actually invite you to turn to Genesis chapter 6, because this begins the very story of Noah and what happens in the flood and the story of suffering that we see here. See, in Genesis chapter 6, beginning with verse 3, the Lord said, my spirit shall not abide in man forever, for he is flesh. His days shall be 120 years. God announces, look, my patience is wearing thin. This world has become so corrupt, I just cannot put up with it anymore. An end is coming. In verse 5, the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And hear this, it says, and the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. So the Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land, man and animals and creeping things and birds of the heavens, for I am sorry that I've made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. And as the story continues, we find that God comes to Noah and says, look, I'm gonna send a flood. I want you to build an ark. I'm gonna send animals to you. I'm gonna save just you and your wife and your sons and their wives. That's it. Out of all of humanity, that's it. 8 people. So for the next 50, 60, 70 years, Noah and his sons and their wives construct this ark. The whole time the ark is being built, it's still a prophetic word that's being sent out to all of those that can see it. They're watching Noah build this ark. Noah, what are you doing? I'm building an ark. Why? Because God's going to send a flood and destroy it all. God gave him 120 years to repent, to change their ways. The patience of God was so great. But the day finally came. God said, get everything in the ark. A couple more days, it's going to happen. So Noah brought everything in, the animals and his family and their supplies. And God shut the door to the ark. I can only imagine what the people outside the ark were thinking. Well, what's happening here? Where's all this rain? Where's this flood? Where's all this destruction? And then the first drop, and the next drop, and the next drop, and the fountains were open, and the rains poured, and the flood happened. And people who were eating and drinking and being merry all of a sudden realized, this is real. This is happening. But think about it from Noah's perspective and his family. All of a sudden, they're shut in to this ark. And they can hear from the inside the pounding, torrential pounding of this rain. But that's not all they hear. What do they end up hearing? They hear the pounding, and they hear the scraping on the outside of the ark, and they hear the shouts of women and men and children. Please open up, let us in, save us, don't leave us out here. Pounding and pounding and pounding. Must have been so deafening that I can just imagine some of them saying, we can't deal with this anymore. And I can imagine some of Noah's family moving inward as much as they could to the innermost part of the ark, just so they didn't have to listen to the pounding and the screaming and the crying and the yelling of men and women and children. And one by one, the pounding stopped. The cries for help stopped. And they heard that last knock and that last cry for help. And they realized it was over. There was no one else, just them. I can imagine them just sitting there looking at one another and wondering, what is going to happen to us? And then there's the jerk of the ark as it gets dislodged from its place and they begin to float. And it's not just this soft float. I mean, it's talking about 40 days of rain, 40 nights of rain, of this floating casket being tossed back and forth in the waves. And these 8 people just looking at one another and wondering, what is going to happen to us? The day after day after day after day goes by. 150 days. Does God even know we're here anymore? We don't have an unlimited amount of supply of food. Where is God? Has he remembered us? Does he know that we're here? And this is one of those great parts in the whole passage that we often go to in chapter 8. It says, but God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the livestock that were with him in the ark. And we continue on through the story and the floodwaters. God sends this wind and the floodwaters begin to subside. And finally, after over a year on this floating casket, they come out. God remembered them. God spared them. God redeemed them and has given them a fresh start. But you know, there is a problematic part to this whole Noah narrative. The truth of the matter is, this story really isn't about Noah. This story is really about God himself. Not in the cliche, oh, it's his story and history, but genuinely it is about God himself. Because there is a question really that we get posed, that gets posed for us, that if we really sit and think about this narrative, it ought to challenge us. It really ought to say, God, who are you really? Help us understand the whole meaning of this story. And it comes towards the end of chapter 8. Verse 21. Noah has just built this altar and he's offered up sacrifices. And it says, and when the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I ever strike again, neither will I ever again strike down every living creature as I've done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. Do you hear the problem in this story? See, for those in the world, they might look at this and say, well, then it was just a big waste. Because at the very beginning of the story, why does God send the flood? Because the intentions of their heart are wicked. And here at the end of the story, what do we hear again? The intentions of their heart are wicked. Nothing has changed with humanity. God knows this. In fact, we don't even get past Noah and his sons, and we're already into problems. When Noah finds himself drunkenly exposed, and his son Ham says, hey, look at this. It doesn't even get past Noah and his sons, and we're right back in it again. So the question that gets posed is, well, God, why? Why destroy everything then if nothing changed in humanity? See, we often focus on just the grace of God in this passage, and we focus separately on the judgment. It depends on what kind of mood we might be in that day, on which one we want to emphasize as preachers. Some days we say, it's about the judgment of God. On other days, it's the grace of God. We determine, based on our mood or based on the circumstances or situations of our ministry at that point, whether we want to focus on the judgment of God in this passage or the grace of God in this passage. See, the judgment upon this wicked, violent world, a world that really doesn't seem much different than our own now. When you turn on the TV and it's just report after report of violence and wickedness. But then there's the grace of God and that he saved Noah and his family. But the fact is that God makes this statement before the flood and he makes it after the flood. The truth of the matter is that the world was so wicked, so vile, so corrupted that the holiness of God demanded judgment. It was that bad. There was such a disregard for God's law, for who he was, for what he expected, for the boundaries that he had established. Such a disregard for God. The world was so corrupt that God, in his holiness, had to judge the world. And we see that with the flood. But it was his love that made grace possible. It was the love of God that he could look upon Noah and say, you have my favor. I'm going to spare you. I'm going to spare your family. And maybe this wouldn't be so much of a problem if it was two different stories. You know, here's a story over here where we get to see the grace of God. And over here is a story where we see the judgment of God. But they happen both in one and the same, and the reason given is still the same. And so when we look at this passage, the real question is, how do we reconcile that? How do we reconcile the judgment of God because of the wickedness of man, and yet the grace of God, knowing that nothing has changed? This has been a struggle for me personally with this passage for a number of years. And I think I understand, maybe limited. The only way to reconcile these two is that God chose to suffer. In this particular passage, God suffers. See, the world tends to look at it and say, well, here's just this angry, wrathful, vengeful God that pours out judgment. Why would I want to serve a God like that? In fact, oftentimes we even draw this disconnect between the God of the Old Testament and the God of the New Testament. In the old, we have the God of law and judgment. In the new, we have the God of grace and love. But the truth of the matter is, he's the same God from beginning to end. Pastor, you've been talking about this thread. And I think we have this thread of suffering as well through all of Scripture. And there is this thread of suffering right here in this Noah narrative. You see, God chose to endure, to continue suffering with a humanity that continues in his wickedness. He could have wiped Noah out. He could have wiped everything out. But he chose to suffer with us. He chose to endure with us. This blows my mind when I begin to think about, wait a minute, you mean a God who could have just done away with everything chooses to endure the wickedness of this humanity? How great must his love be? How great must it be? Paul talks about it has no end. It's inexhaustible. There is no height nor depth. There is nothing that can measure the great love of God. And he chooses to suffer with humanity. When I begin to think about my own sufferings in life, either by the decisions of those around me and how it's impacted me, or my own decisions, some of them, yeah, you could be angry with God and shake your fist and say, well, if you love me, then why? But the truth of the matter is when I begin to really think and consider, God suffers. He has always suffered with humanity. And we see this in no greater place than in the embodiment of God when Jesus Christ suffered on the cross. We see it physically, but the truth of the matter is this is not a new suffering. God has been suffering with a wicked, perverse world that shakes its fist at God and says, we don't want you. We want nothing to do with you. Leave us in our own suffering. Instead of saying, God, you chose to suffer with us. I can make it through all of this because of what you have done. Because you suffer, I can endure my sufferings. It's absolutely amazing when we begin to really, if we can really grasp, and I don't think we can. I think it's one of those things that the more we look at it, the more we explore it, the more we really just kind of sit back and ponder and think and consider about our own lives and our own sufferings, but then we take our suffering and put it in light of the suffering of God himself. And it doesn't do away with our suffering. It says, God, if you suffered and you continue to suffer with us, we can make it because you are a God who has always been faithful. Always. And he does not change. How great is the love of God? How great is the suffering of God? Think about our own lives and the decisions that we have made, the consequences we have had to deal with. And yet here is this loving Father who has chosen to endure with us because of his love for us. How do you reconcile the holiness of God that demands justice and judgment with the love of God that makes grace possible? is because this loving God has chosen to suffer with us both in judgment and in grace. You can endure. I don't know what you're dealing with. I don't know what you're going through. But God absolutely does. It may be suffering with an illness. It may be suffering with the loss of a loved one that you just wish was here right now. It may be suffering through the uncertainty of where is my next job? Where is my next meal? You know your suffering. God knows your suffering. And he is faithful and will be faithful to continue to suffer with you and to redeem these moments. I found that in my own life. I grew up in the projects for the better part of my youth with nothing, poverty, a single mother who married a man who was abusive and married another one who just couldn't connect too well and never told me who my father was until I was 22 years of age. And he was already gone. I was a high school dropout. And yet God has redeemed even the decisions in my own life. I still bear the consequences of some of those decisions. But God has taken a high school dropout from the projects and done incredible things. Things that I am so thankful for. And when I look at this particular passage, I'm humbled by more and more every time I think about it, because God chose to endure suffering. He has suffered with me. I have not suffered on my own. You are not suffering on your own. You serve a loving, caring God who suffers with you both in judgment and in grace. God speak to you. Reach your particular situation, even tonight. Because I know that he is more than able. Watch what he will do as he meets you with this. God bless you.